Hello and welcome to South Beach Sessions. I am an old person. I am over 50. And so this name is coming out of the past, Jim Belushi. If you do not know the Belushi name, his brother obviously helped invent Saturday Night Live, made it very popular. He lost him very publicly, and Jim Belushi was given a career by his brother, and now he is basically a marijuana farmer. He is televising his marijuana farming. Growing Belushi is on the Discovery Channel, and I want to talk here to interesting people about interesting things, no matter who they are, what age they are, or where they're from. This marijuana business seems like a real interesting gold rush, and his life has been interesting. So we're going to talk to Jim Belushi about that show, Marijuana Farming. And also, in the middle of this, what's going to happen is you are going to hear, if you have no interest in Jim Belushi or the Belushis, what you need to stick around for is in the middle of this, there is a moment where Mike Ryan starts wandering around, just shaking his fist triumphantly because he is happy that the Grief Eater can make an appearance. He's making fun of me, and I am celebrating with him. And during a grief-eating moment, I punch the microphone, and you will hear that. You should just listen to that point. Even if you're not interested in anything else here, you should just listen to how awkwardly I punch the microphone accidentally because Mike is celebrating my grief-eating, and I am mortified and flailing about. But
I have my regrets, actually, because he was talking about some pretty dark stuff.
Yeah, it's awful of you, but at least people can laugh a little bit before we get to the end of this because we cover some serious ground. But I enjoyed talking to Jim Belushi, so here he is. Jim, how did you get into the marijuana business? It seems very competitive these days. It seems like a lot of people are trying to make some of that marijuana money.
Well, we like to refer to it as cannabis, by the way. There was a gold rush into the recreational expansion of the legalization of cannabis. That's for sure. And I kind of got into that because I have this farm in Oregon, 93 acres, and I didn't know what to grow. And it was legal in Oregon. And I went, wow, the new agriculture. And so I started growing from 48 plants, and now I'm up to, 800 plants.
How difficult is it? Like, what has happened that you didn't expect? I imagine that that's part of what the show covers, right?
It's farming. I'm an actor. I say other people's lines. Right now, I'm growing other people's plants. It's farming. I mean, I have done the study. I'm a little different than the other people that are licensing their names to make money. I'm a farmer and agriculturist at this point. I've got my metaphorical bachelor's degree, and this TV show Growing Belushi is basically my master's thesis. It is about farming. It's about growing, and it happens to be marijuana and all the challenges that we run into. The main challenge is what most farmers fight: gophers, digger squirrels, aphids, rustic mites, grasshoppers. I freak out when I see a grasshopper. The soil's got to be the right mix, the right blend. Perlite to mulch, it's got to be 64 degrees in order for the micronutrients to feed into the roots in order to create the terpene values and the THC values. I mean, I'm different. I'm growing it. I'm boots on the ground.
How did you decide to do it is what I'm asking you.
I just had this great piece of property, and we were right in the middle of what they call the banana belt in southern Oregon, which is the perfect storm for growing. It's got 290 days of sun. I got a beautiful river that I feed the plants from. I got a perfect pH. It's like feeding them Arrowhead water, Fiji water. And it's a beautiful spot and a spiritual spot. You know, the Native Americans were on this spot many, many, many years ago and were unjustly chased off it. But I have a sweat lodge there, and it just was an accident.
I don't understand how 93 acres of cannabis becomes an accident, but explain to us your history.
Well, first of all, it's not 93. It's 93-acre property. We only grow on about an acre.
I'm sorry. An important correction there. I thought you were really a tycoon of the cannabis industry. It sounds like you're a bit of a peasant. Sounds like you're a bit of a cannabis peasant with a mere 1 acre.
I am. My father comes from the mountains of Albania. He was a peasant. And I've returned to the ground as an agricultural peasant. We are growing, you know, maybe 12 to 1,500 pounds a year. We're boutique, high-end flower, very careful, naturally grown, natural ingredients. Yeah, I'm really happy to break even this year.
What has surprised you about the industry? What were you not at all expecting when you got started?
The craftsmanship of this beautiful plant. I mean, Oregon is known as the state of cannabis. I started in, it's like me starting wine in Napa or something. I mean, I had some real competition, but also some real mentors that have taught me the way of how Oregon grows their cannabis, and it's sought after all over the world.
You have said, I've read, you have said that you thought that cannabis could have saved your brother's life. Is that part of sales, or is that something that you really believe at your core, that cannabis and what you're doing in farming is something that could have helped your brother stay alive?
I think it helped a lot of people's lives. I think my brother had CTE from getting his bell rung in football. He was All-State and All-Conference. He had the most tackles in high school. He had a seizure one. I was a senior. We didn't know what was going on. I think when he got into college and started using, you know, alcohol and pot, and I think that was a kind of a medicine, you know. And I think if he was a pothead, he'd be alive today. If we thought of cannabis back then the way we think about it now, we think of it as a medicine. I use it as a medicine for my own PTSD. You know, I microdose it. I take a little bit at a time. I take a little piece of chocolate at night to go to sleep instead of Ambien. I take a little bit of a hit instead of Xanax or hard liquor. You know, it's a pathway for veterans off opiates, a pathway for overprescribed patients. It helps relieve anxiety, sleeplessness, Alzheimer's, PTSD. It's also stimulates creativity, enhances the sound of music, the taste of food, the touch of your lover's skin. It gives you a joyful feeling, a euphoric feeling that brings compassion and empathy. It's all the wellness of cannabis, and that's the journey that I find. And that's the journey that I found in this show that's doing very well, thank God. And I'm hoping to express the safety for people who are curious, because you see me grow it from seed to sale, and you know it's tested, it's clean, it's cared for, it's loved, and it's safe.
Forgive my ignorance. When you mention your own PTSD, what are you talking about there?
Well, look, and I think everybody is screaming inside their body, especially this younger generation. They have such anxiety. But I think we all suffer from some kind of trauma. I mean, not all, but a lot of people. And trauma is caused from traumatic experiences. Like mine was, you know, I've had a few, but one was the loss of my brother in such a public way and in such a tragic way. There's also a severe illness in a family. You know, the number one fear in life is death, but the number two fear in life is the collapse of family. So we fight to keep our families going, and they collapse. They collapse from alcoholism, from a death in the family, from an illness in the family. Divorce is a traumatic experience for the children especially. I've been involved with divorces. My father lost his business to the mob. We were broke. That was traumatic for him. I mean, there's a lot of trauma that happens in people's lives. And we all scream inside. We manage it, but what do we use to manage it? We use alcohol. We use pills. You know, we use addictive behaviors to manage our screaming. All I'm saying is cannabis is a very safe, non-violent, generous of spirit medicine that just produces such great feelings, and I believe helps the collapsed family heal. There was a gentleman I met at a dispensary, a veteran. He said he was a medic in Iraq, and he saw things that happen to the human body, he said, that nobody should ever see. And he said, I have PTSD. The Veterans Hospital said, I have triple PTSD, whatever that means, he said. He said, they gave me a bottle of 600 Oxycontin for it. He said, I got off it. That was a drug. And I can't talk to my wife. I can't talk to my children. I can't sleep. He said, your Black Diamond OG is the only strain I've found that I can talk to my family, play with my kids, and I can sleep. And he teared up and he hugged me. And I said, hey, man, I didn't make this stuff. He goes, no, but you're a steward. And that changed my perception from it being a business into a purpose. This stuff really helps people.
So help me with something here, because the listeners to our shows have said I'm a grief eater, that when people come into these interviews and they sprinkle some grief over what we're doing, that I leap to attention and I immediately attack it. But your last answer had a whole lot of stuff in it that is complicated when you mentioned, you know, the loss of your business or your father's business to the mob. That's not something I have heard before. What is the story behind that?
Actually, that's in the second episode, which is coming on Wednesday night. We go down to, I went down to Columbia with my cousin. I hired a camera to some guys, and we improvised for 9 days. And we went on the Pablo Escobar tour. And my cousin was not happy about that because he felt that was glorifying him. And that discussion comes up about his father, who grew up next to my dad in Albania. And my dad, and what happened when they were running restaurants in Chicago, and how the mafia, would put pressure on them. And eventually they pushed my dad out of business and took it from him. My dad sat in the backyard at the picnic table in shorts and a T-shirt smoking Chesterfield cigarettes for 3 years. Talk about trauma. And I believe that trauma, you learn it as a child and you pass it on. Traumas can pass on for 5 generations. Suicide, the drug overdose, an untimely death. It carries on for generations.
So what are the specifics, though? Your father is smoking cigarettes in the backyard. What do you remember about the mob as a kid? Were you too young to realize what was happening there?
Yeah, no, I was too young, and my father really didn't talk about it until many, many years later. But he basically said at one point they came to him and said, how's your children, Adam? How's Mary and Johnny and Jimmy? And he said at that point, it was an implied threat. And, you know, they compromised him, and he got out.
When you say that losing your brother in a public way was particularly hard, what is the difference between grieving privately and grieving publicly that made it especially hard, given that you were already in a great deal of pain?
Well, you and I are talking. I don't know anything about your family. You could have had a sibling that passed. And if you trust me enough and it's a feeling you want to share with me, you'd bring it up and we'd have a nice, deep conversation about it. But if you didn't, I would never know. For me, everybody knows. Everywhere I go to this day, 38 years later, people still say to me, I'm sorry about your brother's loss. And I say, thank you. And I say, I loved your brother. And I say, I loved him too. Thank you very much. So I couldn't hide my pain, which is good also because it forced me to deal with it. But it's, you know, it was an international deal back then, you know. That's what I mean. You can't keep it private.
You can't hide from stuff like that. The Belushi name is something that's synonymous with comedy, so I would like to talk to you about some of the lighter stuff in your life. Saturday Night Live. You were there early 80s. What does Jim Belushi consider the best time at Saturday Night Live, just from a viewing experience?
It's the first season with John and Chevy and Danny and Gilda and Lorraine. I mean, Garrett, it's the first season. I mean, they turned that generation up on its head. They were a reflection of what their generation was feeling, and they articulated with just such biting satire. And it was beautiful, and it was smart, and it was funny. And I remember talking to John about it, because he quit after 4 years. And I said, John, what are you doing? He said, look, it's like high school, Jimmy. Freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, it's time to go. Time to make movies. He said, I don't know why anybody would want to do this after us. We captured the hearts of America. No one will be able to do that again. And you know what? It was the best time because they did capture the hearts of America.
And then you did it after him, which he would have advised you not to do, or you did it for a couple of years, right?
Well, I was a Second City actor. John, Danny, and Gilda were Second City actors. Bill Murray, Second City actors. So that formula was an extension from a stage medium to a television medium, and they were successful at it. So for all us Second City actors, that's where you want to go. That's where you want to be. So it was a natural thing for me when they asked me to do the show. I was like, yes. Everybody told me no because of John, and I went, hey, man, I'm just a comic actor, man. I got an opportunity to do the show. I'm going to do it. Well, they're going to kill you for it, you know, because of John. I went, I don't know what you're talking about. And by the way, when I did the show, everybody was nice to me. The audiences were very warm to me. I was very gently embraced. So it was a big deal to do for me. I was a little immature when I did it, but it took me, again, I only had 2 years, sophomore year. I was just starting to get it. That last semester, that spring, I was just starting to get the medium. And unfortunately, you know, then Lauren came back and recast everybody, but I would have liked to have 2 more years.
Do you have a particularly memorable live television disaster?
No, not that I can think of. I had a minute and a half to get out of a wig, change my makeup, change my costume, dress as a woman, put a bra on, stuff bra, a dress, a skirt, a wig, you know, rouge, eye makeup, and we did it in a minute and a half. I had 7 people on me, and that was kind of exciting. Could have been a disaster, but they're all pros.
How crazy is the schedule? Because people think it's all fun, but I have heard the stories. We've talked to too many SNL people around here where it is just you're binging adrenaline, and God knows what you guys were doing in private because it was New York City. You were young, as you said, immature. And those after parties are legendary for being drug fueled.
At my time, I mean, you know, people like to make up stories and exaggerate things. But to be honest with you, we weren't really doing anything. It was a pretty straight cast. Because it takes so much out of you, you never want alcohol or drugs to get between you and the work. And the parties themselves, look, if you have 2 beers and you're dead to the world because your body just drops after that adrenaline dump. So, I mean, I would sleep for 12 hours. But, no, we worked really hard, man. It's hard work. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, including 2 divorces. I mean, this was hard stuff. But it was like doing a MASH unit in Vietnam. It was like you were thrown into live TV and changing lines between commercials. Oh, man. Cutting for time. It was cool, though.
Jim, how can you say that it's the hardest thing you've ever done, including 2 divorces? That sounds impossible.
Well, no. It was really hard. I mean, it was so hard that Dick Ebersol actually fired me at Christmas because I was a bit of an emotional wreck. And, you know, I did a couple stupid things. I threw a fire extinguisher at him one time. tensions were so high. Anyway.
Wait. Why did you throw a fire extinguisher at...
I don't know where I was at. Who knows? You're scared. You're insecure. You're young. You're stupid. You know, you're learning. You just, you know, I'm like a bull, you know, in a china shop. I'm not like some, you know, subtle kind of guy, you know. You know how I feel, you know. And he fired me, and then I came back in January, a month, and I came back, and I begged for my job back, and he put me on probation, and he really changed my life by giving me that second chance, believing in me. And metaphorically, he put his arm around me and watched me and cared for me. And that was the second semester of sophomore year. That was my best, most prolific work. And I'm grateful to Dick Ebersole for, you know, being a good manager and straightening my ass out.
What were you an emotional wreck about? Was it the work? Was it your brother? Was it all of it?
No, it wasn't my brother as much it is the work. You know, it's very competitive on that show to get in that first 30 minutes. That show never fought competition. The only competition it had was sleep. And so the first half hour, they only used two commercials. You know, they had to put 9 commercials on in an hour and a half, and they'd only use 1 or 2 commercials in that first half hour. Then they'd load up the second hour because that's when the ratings would go down anyway. And so to get in that first half hour was very competitive. So it's like, who are you going to work with? Who are you going to write with? Trying to get the scene in, trying to get the host in your scene, because if the host is in the scene, it's more likely to be in the first half hour. You know, it's just the politics of business. It's just, and you know, I wasn't really savvy, so I would kind of lose my shit from time to time, you know.
Was it the rejection of the comedy? Because that has to be tough for a young comic, the idea that it's competitive and the other guys, the other women are getting you know, more attention for politics.
Or you know what, you know, I gotta be honest with you, it wasn't that, the rejection of the comedy, it was the politics. I was not politically savvy. I'm still not politically savvy. And I just fell to the politics. And it's as simple as that.
You had mentioned that you had a couple of outbursts and that one of them was throwing a fire extinguisher at Dick Ebersole. What were the other ones?
I just remember that one the best because I think it's quite funny and simple of me being some bull in a china shop. But you know what? I do explore a lot of these things that you're talking about in Growing Belushi, because it's not called Growing Pots. It's called Growing Belushi. So there's many different levels that are going on. It's all about the cultivation and learning. As I learn, the audience learns about the safety and what goes into it and the processing from curing to trimming to sale to growing. But it also is about the business, the cannabis business. It's a new business. But it's also about me as a person growing alongside of this plant and how this plant has helped me see things in my own life. And especially with John and the trauma that I experienced from that. Because I think people that are in cannabis are really suffering from PTSD. And they use this as a medicine. And I wanted to share how it helped me. And it's a beautiful piece. Very funny. Very funny. Me and my cousin Chris. Very informative. Exotic. We go to Colombia. This week, we go to Colombia. Boy, it's pretty cool.
Jim, that was an expert professional segue by you where I asked you a question and you just put right in there a promo for your show, Growing Belushi, Discovery Channel. I have seen a portion of it. It seems like your family, your cannabis family, requires a great deal of upkeep. That you're the boss, but it feels like you got a couple of real airheads that you're loyal to there, that you're supporting, that aren't doing their job very well. That must be frustrating.
Well, especially since you're talking about Ben and Alex. I've known them since they were born. And, you know, they're like kids, you know, and it's like, it's difficult, you know. You want them to learn, teach them, and but actually, in actuality, they're excellent growers, and they have tremendous knowledge about the plant, and they physically helped me build that place. I mean, digging ditches, putting up fences, cutting the trenches, building the boxes. I mean, they, you know, in the show, they're kind of funny and goofy, but they're really quite competent young men.
They don't work hard enough. What are you talking about? Like, that's very nice of you to say.
Oh, that's Chris. That's Chris. That's Chris's point of view. He's always, you know, he was in a restaurant business. I go, Chris, this isn't the restaurant business. We're not serving 180 people at lunch. This is a different pace. It's a slower pace. It's growing. Growing things are slow, right? So is caring. So stop trying to make them dishwashers and busboys.
How did you come about hiring SNL's drug dealer to run your empire?
Well, I would re-qualify that. I wouldn't say that he was SNL's drug dealer. That doesn't really categorize him correctly.
That's how you characterize him in the clip that I saw. What do you mean? Like, I saw that clip where they said that he was the guy who was supplying SNL with the marijuana. Did you not see the clip that I'm talking about?
Well, wait a minute. You just corrected yourself. You said drug dealer, and he was a weed dealer. He sold weed, which I consider medicine. I wouldn't categorize it as a drug. So I just want to be clear on that. That's all.
Okay, it's a fair correction that you've made there, but I did it for shock value, Jim. I
love shock value, and I appreciate it as long as it's authentic.
I would have thought a Belushi would have eaten up me doing that, but your cannabis protection, you went straight into, I need people to understand that this is not harmful. This is not drug dealer. I understand why you would do that, but you're a Belushi. Like, I thought you would appreciate just something jarring like that thrown in the middle of the interview.
I appreciate it as a professional, interviewer, but you're interviewing me. And, you know, my number one fear in life is being misunderstood. So I have to clarify things. That's all.
Okay. So not death. Your ultimate fear in life is not death. It's just being misunderstood and protecting this SNL marijuana dealer that wasn't a drug dealer.
You're cracking me up, man. Where are you going?
I'm just asking you about one of the characters on your show.
Wait a minute. I'm feeling like I'm talking to my wife here. Now stop it.
All right, fair enough. We will not argue.
We are going in a somatic circle. You know what I do when I talk to my wife? I smoke this. I take one hit off this cherry pie strain because I called the marriage counselor, and I think you should. I should send some marriage counselor to you.
Please feel free. I don't know whether that's legal coming over the lines from Oregon to.
No, I can't actually. Unless you're in Oregon, I can't.
Okay, so we can break the law though together if you like. Anyway, the question I was trying to ask you is: this person who runs your empire or helps you run your empire is someone that goes back a ways with Saturday Night Live, goes back to when you were there in the early '80s.
No, Captain Jack was around in the mid-70s. He was Danny Aykroyd's friend. And Danny Aykroyd and Tom Davis were prolific writers on the show, and they used the Captain Jack strain quite a bit to keep them up those late Mondays and Tuesday nights and writing and coming up with great, great, great ideas. I mean, I swear Coneheads must have came out of this Captain Jack strain. I met Captain Jack when I started doing the Blues Brothers with Danny just because he came to the gigs. And then when I started the farm, Danny said, oh, well, you should get Captain Jack. He's got a beautiful strain. Oh, my God, it's so beautiful. So I hired Captain Jack for him to grow his strain. I don't leave my empire to him.
Can you explain to me what the relationship is with Dan Aykroyd? Because you do Blues Brothers stuff with him, right?
Oh, he is so great, man. He is like a brother, man. He took He took me under his wing when John passed. So did John Candy. They were so loving to me. And when I did my first show on Saturday Night Live, the biggest moment of pressure, John Candy was the host, and he came on to the set. I mean, he came into the offices, and he goes, "Jimmy, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Oh, John, they want to know what you want to do." He goes, "Oh, Jimmy, come on. This is your first show. What do you want to do?" I did six scenes with John Candy that first night. I mean, talk about love and generosity. And Danny dragged me into the Blues Brothers. I didn't want to do it. I said, "Isn't it weird?" He goes, "Oh, no, Jimmy, absolutely not. It's like a law firm. When one of the partners goes down, the brother comes in." And I went, "Well, if you don't think it's weird, then I'll try it." And I got to tell you, he opened up my chest, pulled my heart and soul out with that music, and reshaped my soul and love and my enjoyment of performing music. So he is very special to me. He's in the show, Growing Belushi, on Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock. He is in the show.
You're good at it. You're good. You're a pro.
I'm a pro, man.
You have gotten those plugs in.
My segues aren't that subtle, but I do it.
The Belushis are not known for their subtlety. I don't think. When I think Belushis
work. No, I am not known for my subtlety at all.
Jim, thank you for being on with us. We appreciate you giving us so much time.
Oh, hey, man. It was a joy talking with you. Thanks for the back and forth. You're really fun.
Thanks to Jim Belushi. We ask you, as always, to please subscribe, rate, and review when it comes to the Lebatard and Friends Network. It helps support all this stuff we're doing and keeps it free. Next week on South Beach Sessions, Ethan Strauss has been with us for a long time. He's actually been someone who's been influenced by this show in the way that he reports on things, thinks about things, and he's written a book about the Golden State Warriors, a fascinating team. He's an excellent reporter, but more than that, he's an excellent observer of things in the macro. And so if you want an interesting look at how the Golden State Warriors rose to success and then broke apart, you will get it next week from Ethan Strauss.